Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Today's guest graduated from Stanford University and Hastings College of Law, and he practiced law for 25 years. Jim Bottomley spent 25 years in prison. In his last prison at San Quentin, he participated in a weekly creative writing program for 11 years and developed skills as a writer. Here are the words of his editor, Christine Murray, in the foreword to Jim Bottomley's collection of short stories, A Fresh Start. She writes, "Early in his imprisonment, Bottomley found the prospect of more than a few years behind bars unimaginable. In desperate letters to family and friends, he described the physical discomfort, frightening companions, bad food, intrusive noises, and tedium of being in jail. He twice attempted suicide, hoping to spare himself an ordeal he was certain would be too overwhelming to endure. The misery of prison life was compounded by Bottomley's guilt at the violent act that landed him there, facing a 40-to-life prison sentence at the age of 51. He chronicled his difficult adjustment to incarceration in a 2016 memoir, Free Fall from Grace, which also explored the events leading up to his crime. The book inspired an episode of a true crime television series. In the years since he took a friend's advice and wrote his own story, Jim Bottomley has continued to write, deploying his innate attention to detail to produce dozens of fiction pieces, ranging from short stories to novels. While his pastime has not removed the prison bars, it has given him a measure of freedom to inhabit faraway places in his mind." And those are the words of his editor, Christina Murray, in the foreword to his collection of short stories, A Fresh Start, and Other Stories. So now I'm going to let Jim Bottomley read you what he wrote in his preface. Jim?
Okay. The stories in this collection were all written in prison between 2015 and 2022. I've been in prison since 2000 for a serious crime, but I hope to be released soon. And of course, I was released in February of 2025. Although my prison experiences have influenced my writing, I have written only two stories which relate directly to the life in prison, neither of which have been included here. Instead, I have relied on my imagination in writing these stories, many of which are derived tangentially from my own background. My time in prison has been rather stifling and monotonous, so I have used my memory to retrieve events from the 51 years of my life prior to my crime. Many of my writings are focused on relationships and drawn on my background as a child, student, husband, lawyer, father, and mentor. I grew up in La Jolla, California, and received an excellent education at La Jolla Junior and Senior High Schools, Stanford University, and Hastings College of the Law. In 1974, I received a JD from Hastings and passed the California bar exam. I became a practicing attorney and remained such until the day of my life crime. I worked for two law firms before establishing my solo practice in 1981. My ex-wife, Susie, and I raised three amazing children. Before my incarceration, I enjoyed such activities and hobbies as surfing, golf, backpacking, coaching youth sports, and reading. Despite the material advantages of an upper middle class background, I have spent my whole life feeling that I've had a dark cloud over me. From a little boy trying and failing to please my parents and teachers to an adolescent experiencing the mood swings that decades later would be diagnosed as bipolar disorder, I have suffered from depression, low self-esteem, obsessions, compulsions, sleep disruption, and manic periods. I now manage this disorder with several medications that help moderate the symptoms, but they are still painful. I believe this disorder played a significant role in participating in my life crime. My creative writing has been a major factor in helping me cope with my bipolar disorder. When I feel depression coming on, I can write or rewrite, and my mood is elevated. When I feel panic, writing helps calm me down and find a peaceful place. Writing has also improved my self-esteem. My writing instructor, Zoe Mullery, has been an enormous positive force in my life. I have cherished her instructions in weekly seminars, which require each student to write a short story and read it to the group, which then shares criticism and accolades. I would not have been able to write these stories without the support and love of my three children, Jeff, Courtney, and Kristen. I give my profound gratitude to my editor, Christina Murray, for her outstanding work in keeping me on the straight and narrow, and to my dear friend, James D. Jameson, for making this project possible. I have written all my stories in my cell, at the prison library, or on the prison yard. I write some drafts in longhand on yellow legal pads and then type them on my mini word processor or send them to a friend outside the prison to type for me. Other stories are composed directly on the word processor. I have loved every minute of writing the approximately 75 short stories that I've undertaken. Novels, novellas, essays, and poems are daunting challenges for me, but short stories seem to come easily. I simply allow my imagination to come up with storylines and then fill in the beginning, descriptions, characterization, dialogue, denouement, and closing. I edit and rewrite the story several times until I arrive at a satisfactory final draft. I try to include one or more moral lessons in my stories, but that is not a requirement.
Thank you, Jim. This is my guest, Jim Bottomley, reading from his collection of short stories. And the title of the short stories is A Fresh Start. And I mentioned that your foreword is written by your editor. And she mentions two stories. She says, your vivid settings and such titles as A Really Fun Day and A Father's Tale demonstrate Jim's ability to evoke environments far different from those of his daily life. And she mentions A Father's Tale. And I would like you to read from A Father's Tale because your dad, and you were raised by your father and mother, your dad was a Navy veteran of World War II. So I enjoyed reading the story you wrote, and the title of this story is A Father's Tale. So would you turn to that section of your book? It's toward the end of your collection. And would you turn to that section of your book and start reading from A Father's Tale?
My father has never been much of a talker, and he especially avoided talking about the war he fought in, World War II. Growing up, my brother and I would ask about his experiences in the Pacific Theater, but he would brush us off with vague excuses like, that was a long time ago, I don't remember much, or I don't have time to talk about it right now. All this changed one recent evening when my mother came downstairs carrying a thin, ragged piece of metal about the size of my pillow. My name is Josh, I'm 13 years old, and this is my father's story about the battle for the Japanese island of Okinawa. Brandishing the homely hunk of metal, Mom asked Dad pointedly, what do you want to do with this? I won't call it a junk, so let's just say it's a relic. The rest of us were sitting around the dining table. Dad and my younger sister, Casey, were still eating. My 16-year-old brother, Jeff, and I cleaned our plates, but had not yet been excused. Dad liked to run a tight ship, and we were all expected to remain at the table until everyone had finished the meal. Normally, Mom followed this rule as well, but she had been on one of her cleaning kicks all day and apparently couldn't wait to get back to it. I wondered later if she picked that moment to come downstairs so she could ambush Dad while he was still at the table. It's been in the closet for years collecting dust, she said, her voice full of disdain for this mysterious object. We've got to throw it out.
Excuse me, Jim, for interrupting, but I just want to remind listeners that even though this story is told in the first person, this is not you speaking. This is your character. I just wanted to, because the next sentence starts, we kids were wide-eyed, and so I just wanted to remind listeners that you aren't, this isn't a true story about you, although I'm guessing that there's some truth in it. Is that correct, Jim?
Yeah, the story is really a story within a story, of course, mm-hmm. and there is quite a bit of autobiographical point of view that the kid, the 13-year-old kid, has. You know, it really did happen quite a bit like this in mm-hmm. my real life. And my dad did tell us a story, finally, of the Battle of Okinawa. He fought in a lot of battles in the Pacific Theater, but Okinawa was the one he focused on for us, and that's where he collected this relic from the plane, the kamikaze plane.
Well, I'll let you read that, because I'd like you to continue what you wrote, but I think this is more typical than not of the generation that fought in World War II. They did not want to talk about it, and we can certainly understand why. Anyway, so let's pick up, Jim, when this young boy is saying, we kids were wide-eyed.
Okay. Should I pick up where I left off then?
Yeah, if you would, please.
Okay. He's saying it's been in the my mom said it's been, or the mom said it's been in the closet for years collecting dust. She said, her voice full of disdain for this mysterious object. We've got to throw it out. We kids were wide-eyed with mystery and awe, suspecting that my father's sentiment for the filthy-looking piece of metal must have been deep if he saved it for so many years. My father had never been a collector. As far as I knew, he never kept any photos from the war or his youth on the East Coast. That's why I was so surprised when he spoke. I'm keeping it, Liz, he informed her simply. It's important to me. My mother was tenacious and impatient. She didn't give up easily about anything. I heard her voice yelling as a patch of tomatoes to grow faster. She wasn't going to go back down over a useless piece of metal scrap. She demanded, why do you want to keep that old piece of junk? It takes up space we need for other things. My father turned to all of us. Gather around, he said. It's time you heard the story behind this piece of metal. Maybe you'll understand why this souvenir means so much to me. We kids sat in a semicircle on the living room carpet with our backs to a roaring fire. Dad sat down in his usual reading chair in front of us. Our mother glanced around fretfully for a moment, probably reluctant to abandon her closet cleaning project, before perching on the edge of an ottoman on the one side of the fireplace. Kids, I'm going to tell you a story about this piece of metal that you've never heard before, Dad said. Mom, you may remember some of this tale. He didn't have to tell us to listen closely. The mystery of the metal artifact, combined with a rare storytelling moment from my father, had riveted our attention. When he began to speak, we were all ears. It was the spring of 1945. Our country had been at war with Germany and Japan for over 3 years. Germany was already defeated in Europe, and the Japanese were hanging tough, holding on to heavily fortified islands such as Okinawa, the closest island to mainland Japan. I had been stationed on a Navy destroyer ship in the Pacific Ocean for all this time, racking up one victory after another. Our vessel cut through the water like the Pacific bottlenose dolphins that constantly swam in the wake behind us. I was only 23 years old, but still the veteran of our crew. A sailor or soldier ages fast during wartime. My shipmates and I were wary of war, but we still had a job to do. My team was in charge of the gun on the aft deck. From there, we could fire effectively, but were an easy target for any Jap planes who evaded our defenses. Jeff interrupted. Isn't the word Jap slang for Japanese? Dad answered, It is a name we use to call our enemy. Yeah, Dad, but isn't it offensive to the Japanese people these days? I suppose so. Kids, don't ever use that word Jap in public. Got it? We all agreed, and so he continued in his composed, even manner. So then he goes on to tell the story about the Okinawa, the Battle of Okinawa.
This is my guest, Jim Bottomley, and he is reading from his collection of short stories, A Fresh Start and Other Stories, and this chapter is entitled A Father's Tale. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, former lawyer Jim Bottomley, and I'm asking about his collection of short stories, A Fresh Start. And we're hearing why he's telling this story. He hasn't ever told his children about this, what happened. And rather than have you read it, you had started to tell us what takes place in the rest of this chapter is, it was hard. I found it fascinating, but it was hard to read, Jim. So what would you like listeners to know about the rest of this story, A Father's Tale?
Just like this, the dad in the story, my dad fought on a Navy destroyer. They call them picket ships because the destroyers were assigned the job of protecting the aircraft carriers. And the aircraft carriers were essential for the attack on the island because the planes played a big big role in that. My dad's job was, he was chief crewman of a one of the guns, the big guns on the destroyer. And it was, the Japanese did not attack the, there were hundreds of ships that the Americans had ready to attack the island. And my dad, you know, his role was to shoot down the planes as the Japanese planes attacked the ships, particularly the aircraft carriers. So it was a very important job that he had. And the father in the story has basically the same job. And the story goes on to tell about the kamikaze aircraft that attacked. Because the Japanese were very desperate. They had lost their Navy, and they basically had their airplanes to attack the ships. And one of their tactics was to use kamikazes. These were suicide planes, basically to ram the fly right into the ship and act like a bomb. And that's what happened in this story. The kamikaze attacks the destroyer and kill some of my dad's, the father's crewmates.
Now, you started to say your dad's crewmates. Did that actually happen? Because in the story, the father loses crewmates, they get killed. And did that, was that the case with your dad? Did some of his crewmates get killed right there when he was present, when he was there?
Yes. It really happened that way. He lost some crewmates, and that piece of metal was a piece of the kamikaze plane. It talks about the pilot still conscious in his cockpit, right there on after he had landed on to, or not landed, but crashed into the destroyer. And that's where that piece of metal came from that my dad kept all those years.
Well, you have such a variety of stories and situations. Some of them are told third person. This one we just were listening to was told in the first person. So we feel like, gosh, that sounds like that's actually Jim speaking what this 13-year-old boy was saying. Now, another story that your editor mentions, she mentions A Dad's Tale, and she mentions A Really Fun Day. And that was a scary story, Jim. What's A Really Fun Day about?
Well, it's the opening story of my stories, and one of my favorite stories. I completely made it up. I think I saw a story on the TV about sharks, people going down in cages view great white sharks. And to me, that seemed like a really weird thing to do, but it stimulated my story about that. It's about a young couple from San Francisco that take a shark viewing cruise out to the Farallon Islands, which are true islands that exist off of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco.
Well, now, by the way, you're very familiar with the ocean yourself. You were a surfer.
Yes. Yes, I love the ocean. I've been around the ocean my whole life. In my preface, that I grew up in La Jolla and down in Southern California. And I grew up about a block from the beach. So I naturally started surfing when I was about 10 years old. And I surfed up until the time that I started having kids of my own. So I quit surfing then. Then later in life, I picked up surfing again on a longboard. And I loved it. I kept surfing. I think I surfed the day before my crime. That's how much it was part of my life.
Well, this story I mentioned is a scary story, Jim. And the scary part is it involves a shark. So I'm going to ask you to read a section from this story, A Really Fun Day. And the young woman's name is Melinda.
The woman in the story, the young woman, Melinda, is down in the shark cage. She's down below the boat. They drop her down, and she sees a shark coming toward her, which is what she wanted to do. And so here we go. For Melinda, the sound had changed to a repetitious gurgle as gravity sucked the cage down. She wondered whether her final destination would be the ocean floor or hanging midwater, where the sharks could attack her from all angles and rip her to shreds. That question was answered seconds later when the cage stopped with a jolt, bouncing her off her fins and across the floor into the bars. She stood up, dazed, and looked around, but she couldn't see much. She realized that if she was going to view sharks, they'd have to swim awfully close to the cage. What was that old and overused phrase? Up close and personal. She reflected on her situation alone, isolated from all help, and trapped behind the bars in a totally alien environment. She asked herself, is this how a prisoner feels? Bars all around, confined space, menace lurking. Do I feel free of the world above or caught in the world below? At that moment, she saw an obscure object moving toward her. As it approached out of the shadows formed by the gloomy water, she recognized it as a massive shark, her prey, exactly what she came to view. She assumed that it was a great white. What other shark could be that big? The first blow against the cage was ferocious. It slammed Melinda hard to the floor, and she failed to rise again. The shark seemed to have performed this role before. With one crushing blow after another, its attack was relentless and primarily focused in one spot. The bars began to separate right away, and the hole grew with every blow. This was frightening, similar to the attack that Thomas had told her about. She closed her eyes so she wouldn't have to witness the brutal finality of it. Feel it, yes, the rows of sharp teeth ripping into her flesh, thrashing at the veins in her neck, the excruciating pain until she felt nothing at all. Yet, she reasoned, with her eyes closed, albeit a disadvantage. She was a smart girl from Stanford with potential in marketing, many social friends, and a loving boyfriend. She had a bright future ahead that she hoped would include a family. Never in a million years had she envisioned that her final seconds would be in the jaws of a shark crunching her bones and sinking its teeth into her skull in an ancient quest for survival. She was no different than the shark's regular play, a harbor seal or perhaps a husky sea lion. With that thought, she finally started to cry.
This is my guest, Jim Bottomley, and he is reading from his collection of short stories entitled A Fresh Start and Other Stories. And the title of the chapter he was just reading from is A Really Fun Day. And to some of us, Jim, that doesn't sound like a fun day to me. But you, since you love the ocean, you imagined, and this is from your imagination, as you told us. This is not something that actually happened to anybody that you knew. But people might wonder, well, did she make it out alive? Because this is pretty dangerous, this shark there. Anything else you want to add? You don't want to spoil the fun, but anything else you want to add to A Really Fun Day, Jim?
Yeah, well, of course, the title is ironic because it turned out to be not such a fun day. Melinda is, the shark opens a big hole and Melinda is able to escape. She has her diving gear on and she escapes and climbs back on the back of the boat. But her boyfriend thinks that she's been, you know, they haul up the cage and the cage has a big hole in it and no Melinda. So the boyfriend assumes that Melinda's been eaten by the shark and he makes a foolhardy move of donning scuba gear and he dives into the water to try to save her. Of course, the shark gets him. I don't describe that. I just describe it as him diving into the water. And Melinda comes back to the people where the people are gathered around the shark cage and the captain. And she says, "Where's my boyfriend?" And the captain says, "Well, he dove in after you to try to save you." And she, obviously, the story takes a little bit after Romeo and Juliet.
Exactly. That's immediately what we think of Shakespeare when we see what happens to this couple.
Yeah, she, the captain asked her if she's going to dive in after her boyfriend to save him, and she says, no way I'm going to do that. Yeah. I'm no Juliet. And
was similar to Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, it's kind of based on that at the end. But obviously, the boyfriend dies at the shark. The shark gets his boyfriend, and that's the end of the story. But it's not based on anything I've ever done. It was just totally out of my imagination. But it was provoked by a story that I saw on TV about going down the cages. And
the ocean was familiar. The ocean is familiar territory for you. Now, there's another story that I think you drew perhaps on your experiences. I'm not going to ask you to read from The Women's Track Club, but what inspired you to write a short story about The Women's Track Club?
I think I might have seen on TV depiction of the women's track running. And I really can't remember why I wrote that story, but I love that story because in two stories, I take the point of view of the woman in the story. That story and then the A Fresh Start is about a young woman who I also take the point of view of. And so I feel kind of proud that I was able to write those stories from the woman's point of view.
I might mention, excuse me, but the title of the entire collection is A Fresh Start, but then the last short story in the collection is A Fresh Start. So that's what you're referring to. And
yes.
You mentioned that A Really Fun Day is one of your favorite stories, and also The Women's Track Club is a favorite of yours. And
yes.
Why is that, Jim?
Yes. And I love the long story. I wrote a long story that's part of the collection, and it's called Smiles We Left Behind, which is based on a song from a Barbara Streisand movie that has that song. She sings Memories, and it has that phrase in there, Smiles We Left Behind. And I love that story, too, because it kind of reminds me of me, the old man in the story. Is 70 years old, and I wrote the story when I was about 76 or something like that. But I love that story as well. But would you like me to finish about the Women's Track Club?
Yeah. How were you inspired to write the story of the Women's Track Club?
Yeah. It just came to me. It was, solely out of my imagination. Obviously, it's all about the women in the track club. So,
which is why you would tell it in the third person. The ones like the young boy, you tell in the first person, but these couple of women, you tell in the third person, this short story. Okay, excuse me.
Right. I wrote in the first person that story and The Fresh Start. I really cannot remember how that clicked in my mind. I just start, when I write a short story, it's usually based on something. It might have been a prompt. Oftentimes, Ms. Mullery gave us prompts to write stories on. And I oftentimes wrote my stories based on the prompts Ms. Mullery gave to me. And that might have been why I wrote the Woman's Track story. It might have been because I know in the end, there's a dog, a three-legged dog. And I remember a prompt that Ms. Mullery gave me. That was write a story about in which a three-legged dog makes an appearance. So it must have been a prompt by my writing instructor.
Uh-huh, because this little three-legged dog was crowned the mascot of the Women's Track Club.
Yeah.
So that was a sweet.
At the end of the story, that's exactly right.
Yeah, and so you have these two young women and competing. So I think people will really enjoy, you have such a variety in your collection of short stories, Jim, and I'm sure you keep writing even now that you are free from your incarceration, but you are still going. So we will look forward to your next publication, Jim. Thank you.
Right. I have, like I think I said in the preface, I've written about 75 short stories, and so I'm going to try to take about 10 or 12 of the best ones and publish that as a second volume of short stories. I would like to find a publisher. That's my work so far has been getting my stories already in finished products, and I just want to try to find a publisher down road that I'll be able to. I've written three novels, so I'd like to publish those as well.
Well, we wish you luck with that, and thank you for writing these short stories. Let me remind listeners that the title is A Fresh Start and Other Stories, and the author is James C. Bottomley. Thank you, Jim.
Okay, thank you very much, Nancy. Appreciate it.
After a break, I'll be talking to Maurice Huffman, who is a musician and author of a short story for children. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Local author and musician Maurice Huffman started writing music when he was 15 and has been performing and writing music ever since. He performs original music with his band Big Mo and the Full Moon Band and also owns an import business. Maurice Huffman told his son Miles bedtime stories about an orphan named Jake. Miles advised his dad to write down the adventures of Jake in a hot air balloon, and Miles Huffman is the illustrator of the book. Maurice Huffman, welcome.
Thank you for having me there. Welcome.
I was quite impressed with your son's illustrations. He could be a professional artist.
He is fantastic. He does oils and all kinds of things, and he had one of his paintings was in the MoMA Museum, actually, in San Francisco. So he's a great artist.
Well, then you chose, as your protagonist, the story is about a kid named Jake, and he's an orphan. And I was going to ask you, why did you make your main character an orphan? I have an idea why, but I want to hear what you say.
Well, I knew an orphan, a friend of mine, who told me stories about growing up in an orphanage. And so that kind of started the thing a little bit, and then being in Colorado Springs so often with my in-laws living there and their hot air balloon show they have every year where hundreds of balloons come together, that's kind of how it all came together.
Well, I was thinking if this young kid had family, he is off in this hot air balloon and his family would be wondering, oh, where is Jake? And he would be worried about his family, but he's an orphan.
Yep, yeah,
and
that's right.
And the poor kid... Well, what is his background? What is Jake's background?
Jake's parents were biologists or marine biologists, which was always kind of my dream job. I'm an avid scuba diver and scuba dive instructor in a previous life. And so the marine biology kind of came in there. So in there, his parents' ship sank while he was young in the Caribbean when they were doing some research. So that's how he became an orphan, lost his parents to sea.
And then he's in this orphanage, and he gets bullied?
He gets bullied, yeah. There's some bullies in there, and he gets in trouble for defending himself and some of the other kids. And that came a little bit from when I was a kid. I used to do that, too. I tried to put bullies in their place and helped. That was kind of my role from my size, I guess, when I was a kid. I did that quite often, so I kind of threw that in there.
So even when you were a kid, you were Big Mo?
I was always big and strong, not maybe as wide as now, but yeah.
Well, so this kid goes to the orphanage, and there's something he really wants to get out of there, something he really wants to do, and because of these bullies, he's not going to get to do it.
Yeah, he gets in trouble. Because he was, the bullies were giving him a bad time, and so they got into a struggle. And of course, everybody that was involved in that struggle was not allowed to go to the balloon race, which Jake was so excited about seeing that, because it screams adventure, a hot air balloon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My guest is Maurice Huffman. He's a local writer and musician, and the name of his book is Jake and the Hot Air Balloon. So this young orphan figures out a way to get to this hot air balloon place, and off he goes on this adventure. And I got a kick out of the conversation that takes place, and there's some foreign words in there.
Yeah.
And I had a chance to review a little German, and people might say, well, why is Maurice writing in German? Maurice is a French name, but he's writing in German.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in close to the French border in Germany, and so my mom loved Maurice Chevalier, so I think that's how it happened.
So we have this young kid who goes up in this hot air balloon.
Yeah.
And he thinks he's up there by himself.
Yes, he struggles, hangs on by a rope, almost falls off, and the only hope he had was suddenly this small voice that talked him up the rope and back into the balloon and pretty much saves his life, the words of this tiny mouse that he then saw. That was
and we don't
beat.
Know it's a mouse.
We don't.
When we're reading along and he hears this voice. What?
Yeah.
Where is this voice coming from?
He had no idea.
I'm just wondering, when you're telling your young Miles mm-hmm. this story, I can just see Miles' eyes getting wider.
Oh,
yeah. And who is this voice?
I played the mouse with a sheet. I always had my hand under the sheet, and I would play the mouse, you know, when he was talking, and he just loved the mouse. And
like a little hand puppet.
Little hand puppet. Oh. And it was always so much fun telling him the stories. He was so involved.
Well, so this little mouse starts talking to him.
Yeah.
And they're up in this balloon,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like for you to read part of this conversation with Jake and Milton the mouse.
Yes.
Would you
okay,
read
sure.
a little bit of that for us?
So they decided to rest for a while. So Jake bundled up in a wool blanket he found and sat down to rest. It was very cold up there in the sky. As they were sitting on the floor of the basket resting, the fast winds carried them hundreds of miles to unknown distances. They fell fast asleep until they awoke from hearing a loud noise. I almost sounded like gunfire. Jake looked over the side when a flying object just missed him and hit the balloon above him. Slowly, the hot air balloon started to leak with a loud hiss. "Milton, wake up," he said. "We're being shot at and the balloon is losing altitude." "What? Where? Why?" yawned Milton as yet another bullet hit the balloon. Now they were sinking faster. Milton looked over the side to see where they were heading. He soon made out some high snow-covered mountains as they were heading lower. He saw green meadows and beautiful landscapes. Jake turned up the gas as far as he could and slowed their descent down, but not enough to get higher. They finally got so close to the ground that they could make out a good landing spot. "Okay, this is the tricky part," said Milton. "I hope the wind stays calm so we don't drag too long. Now hang on, here we go." The basket touched ground and bounced a few feet until it came to a final halt. "Now turn off the gas," shouted Milton. So Jake closed the valve and the balloon started to deflate all the way. "Wow," said Jake. "That went smooth. Sure feels good to have solid ground under my feet." For a moment, they were both so happy to be down alive, they forgot why they were forced to land in the first place. In the meantime, they were being surrounded by the people that did shoot them down. "Oh, my God, I think we've hit them." "I hope they're okay," said one of them. "They could be dangerous and try to shoot back," another said. "What should we do?" "The eldest should approach him. After all, he's our leader." "Always me," grumbled the eldest. "It's not like I chose this job. You guys vote me in without asking, and then again, I'm the oldest. So I guess I have no choice, but I do not miss my target. It's always the young ones that can't shoot straight. Then to shoot so far off target to hit a balloon in the sky. Well, that's definitely not my fault," rumbled Fritz the elder. He carefully came out from behind the rocks that were hiding and approached the basket. Jake was just about to climb out of the basket when Milton said very quickly, "Stop. There's someone coming. Looks like some children. I'm going to have to stop speaking. Put me in your pocket so I can hear everything, but be careful. They shot at us, after all." Jake was kind of scared, but not too much, since it looks like they were dealing with some small kids. As the person came closer, though, Jake saw that this kid had a long beard that reached almost to the ground, and it was snow white. He was wearing a long white leather apron that looked like as old as he did. He must not have been any longer than 3 feet, but yet an adult, a very old-looking adult. "Hello, Verzeihung, Verzeihung, wir haben euch nicht mit Absicht beschossen." He's speaking a different language, Jake thought. "Where are we?" "I'm sorry, I don't understand you. I only speak English," shouted Jake. "Ah, no problem, we speak English," said the little man. He came closer and Jake could see that he looked very old, but moved with the agility of a young man. "We are so sorry. We did not mean to shoot you down, you see. We had new recruits, and this was their first day of shooting," said the man in an excited voice. And then Jake saw a few other people peeking from behind some rocks with red faces. They must be the recruits, thought Jake. They did not look any younger than the first guy for being recruits. "Well, ask him what they were shooting at. Don't just stand there," whispered Wilton from Jake's pocket. But before Jake could say anything, the old man continued. "Today was the first outdoor shooting day. You see, when we shoot from the holes in the cheese outside, we shoot are out less windows. In Zavinta, we always have to buy new windows. Did I hear cheese? Milton said. Oh, you must pardon me. Let me introduce myself. I'm Fritz, the master, hole in the cheese shooter, from the battalion number 165-5897. He saluted and almost tripped over his beard as he was trying to stand tall. Hole in the cheese shooter battalion? Jake asked.
Did somebody say cheese? Milton asked.
I think so, whispered Jake.
I believe these are the guys that shoot the hole in the Swiss cheese. We must be in Switzerland.
Are we in Switzerland? Asked Jake.
Well, not really. There's a Swiss hole in the cheese shooter battalion, but I've had to move here to not shoot anybody. Well, at least we did not think that we could shoot somebody here.
So where is here, and why do you shoot holes in cheese? Asked Jake.
Well, we're on a floating alpland.
Floating alpland? You mean island?
Yes, I guess you could call it that. We have a tip of a mountain from high in the Alps that we can move through the air when we want to. We have high precision engines and fill the hollow alpland with helium and float much like your balloon, but we've never expected company here.
Wow, that's amazing. We were shot out of the sky by cheese shooters, said Jake.
This is my guest, Maurice Huffman. He's reading from a book entitled Jake and the Hot Air Balloon, and he's doing the voices of these characters that are cheese shooters.
Yeah. We all wanted to know how we got those holes in this with cheese. Now you do.
And, of course, as soon as this little mouse hears the word cheese, he's immediately interested.
He was so excited. His main food.
Again, the title of this book is Jake and the Hot Air Balloon. So he's off on these adventures, and they're not even sure where they are.
Yeah.
And they get to go to other places that are... Now, you mentioned the Caribbean.
Yeah, you know, since I like diving and swimming and all that water so much, I thought I'd put a lot of that adventure right in the beautiful warm waters where I've taken my son Miles a few times too. So, a lot of time they spent right over the Caribbean with all kinds of adventures. And
so there's another location that takes place in the Caribbean, and then they meet another character, a young woman. And, of course, this is taking place in these beautiful waters of the Caribbean.
Yes, they come across this young lady that's swimming and doing some snorkeling, and they couldn't see the boat, so they thought they had to rescue her.
And so and all she that didn't ensues. Want to be rescued.
She didn't want to be rescued. She was just fine.
Well, this is such a fun book to read, and I can just imagine, I don't know if parents would be able to do the voices that you do, but I can imagine what fun they would have.
And absolutely.
You even said you have a little hand puppet
that was
Milton the Mouse. Now, I mentioned that your son was the illustrator, very talented, and you and he are going to collaborate on another book?
Yes, I've already started. This book is not a big, thick book that, so I figured I would see the reactions of the people and see if they wanted to know how this adventure continues. And I've got a lot of positives about that, so I've already started and intend to write a continuation of this story.
So you and your band perform around Northern California, so people might not only look to see when your next book is coming out, and this one, but also look for you in your role as musician.
Yes, I love performing and have some wonderful friends here that come to the show.
And what kind of music, people might wonder, what kind of music do you write?
I write all the music myself, all the songs. I've got five CDs and two albums out, full of songs. And the genre, a lot of times it gets put into the blues world, but it's also funk and country and just whatever I feel like playing. Most people say, well, it reminds me of the 70s. So,
it's been such a pleasure talking to you, Maurice Huffman.
It's been such a pleasure to meet you. Thank you.
I would also like to thank my first guest, former lawyer and prisoner, Jim Bottomley. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
The Fate of Peace. It cowers in shadows, whispers more softly than a breeze. Many of us hear its quiet call. It begs for water and shelter from thugs who rumble, stomp, slash things, hit it with stones. Peace becomes a refugee who cries no to death. It feels pain, terror, woe, but its fate is to survive, endure, wait for days when people turn their backs on drones, missiles, battles, fools. When those times come, it will be a laughing stream that runs in the woods, a dance troupe that fills city streets. For now, let's hear its whispers and cries. Find it rooms where it can sleep. Bring it water, books, soup, and bread until we can revive. Paul Belts.
A confession. Guido and I eased to the stop beside the Foster's freeze. A woman crossed in front of us, trailing her ragged wheeze. She pivoted between the lines and, locking up her walker, waved the yellowed fingers of the nicotine-fueled talker. Three lanes of traffic at a halt, she fumbled toward my truck, a fearless smile across a face that seemed little of Lady Luck. Ablaze with caking rouge, her cheeks sank deep beneath moon eyes. She speared me with a lunar stare, said, "I about got one of those guys." And she pointed at my Westie in the window now to greet her, then spun back to her walker as the past stomped up to meet her. At the curb, she turned to scream at me, "I got myself pregnant instead. Triplets," she yelled down the sidewalk, shaking her henna-streaked head. Philip Hemingway.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.